issues from a superior point of view. Good morning. Welcome to Simply Superior. Robin Washington is away. I'm Paul Damberg, WPR's Northern Regional Manager. Northeast Minnesota and Northwest Wisconsin is home to many talented writers. This morning we will feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry of writers from across the region. Each year, a group of these writers organize a public reading of the best submissions of talented individuals living throughout the area. These readings were recorded in front of a live audience at past Writers Read events held at Northwind College. The following works are based on the theme of transformation. We will start with a reading from Carol Dunbar right after this news. Welcome back to Simply Superior. Robin Washington is away. I'm Paul Damberg, WPR's Northern Regional Manager. You are listening to an encore presentation of recordings of works at past Writers Read events held at Northwind College.
I'm J.W. Sutton. This story is called 47625 Town Dump Road. Okay, Pops, I think that's the last of them. Yeah, Jimmy, but good, thanks. Harold watched his son toss two full garbage bags into the overflowing pickup bed. That going to fall out on the highway? No, I've got a tarp to tie over it. Jimmy pulled blue plastic from the back seat of the crew cab. They fine you if you let that crap fly out of the truck and don't pick it up. I know, Pops. Can you help me with this? He began to tie a battered yellow rope at one end of the truck bed. Harold limped off the porch. Where's Christy? Children are for helping. She worked hard for 2 hours. I told her she could take a break. Doing what? Reading a book she found at a garage sale. Jimmy pulled the tarp into place, cinched it, and tossed the line to his father. Reading is good. Harold looped the rope through the tie-down. He looked toward the garage. What about all those jugs and cans? That's junk, too. Can't take those, Dad. It's hazardous waste. They'll have a collection notice in the paper, but it'll cost you. It's trash. What's the difference? The old solvents, the dirty oil, it would leak out of the landfill and poison the water. Don't they clean the water? I have a garbage pile in back since before I was born. My water is fine. Jimmy sighed. I can't do it, Pops. I don't have the room anyway. Harold frowned, shrugged, and spread his arms. Thank you so much, son. I couldn't do it on my own. Jimmy leaned into the hug, cradling his father's bent back. You're welcome, Pops. I'm glad I could help. Jimmy stepped back. I'll go stack what's left in the garage, okay? Can you please tell Christy that it's time to leave? I think she's out back. Yeah, son. He limped around the house. Christy was curled in a lawn chair, enjoying the fleeting warmth of the autumn sun. Her clothes and skin wore similar patches of grime. What are you reading? He asked.
Hi, Papa. It's called Tales of the Green Man. It's a bunch of short stories.
Green Man? Is that some hippie thing? Christy chuckled.
No, nothing like that.
She turned the cover for him to see, an old man with leaves for hair and moss for a beard.
The green man is like a forest spirit or fairy. He defends nature in the wild places of the world.
Like a ghost?
She shrugged. Sometimes a stranger rewarding kindness. Sometimes a monster seeking revenge.
Harold raised his eyebrows. Anyway, your father said it's time to go.
Thanks, Papa.
Thank you. You worked hard today. I see it on your face. He wiped a smudge off her cheek.
No problem.
She matched his pace until they rounded the corner. Hop in, kiddo. She gave her grandfather a last quick squeeze. He patted her back. Take care. Call me if you need anything, Pops. I will. Jimmy engulfed Harold in a gentle hug, mindful of the older man's back. Remember to keep an eye out for that hazardous waste pickup.
Yeah, I'll look, he agreed.
Jimmy hopped in the truck. Christie waved. Harold hobbled back inside. It was nearly sunset when the old man returned to the garage. I'm not going to pay some person to take this. That's what I pay taxes for. He opened one of the jugs Jimmy had carefully shelled. Oh, smells awful. Harold surveyed the accumulated waste, decades worth of lubricants and antifreeze and satin finish in the emerald green his wife had loved. I think it is time to take a trip to the garbage pile. He loaded a few jugs into a small wheelbarrow and trudged across the lawn into the trees beyond. 100 yards into the army of wooden sentinels, Harold came upon a rusted Ford. Dragged here by his father, it had decayed so long that a pair of aspens had sprouted and twisted together through the vacant windshield. Scattered and piled around it were bald tires, a bent boat trailer, and less easily identifiable bottles and cans and shards. Harold grabbed the first plastic jug and tossed it into the open passenger window of the old auto. As it crashed inside, a blur rushed across the forest floor and bolted up the nearest tree. Harold clutched at his chest as he jumped back. A raccoon berated him from his safe perch. Bastard! I see you again. I get you with my shotgun. The raccoon merely blinked. Ha! Laughed Harold. The best thing about living out here is no one hears how noisy I am. Harold pitched the rest of the rancid chemicals into his corroded private dump. He spit toward the raccoon and wheeled his way back to the garage. The full moon lit his path. When he returned with another load of refuse, the shadows were deeper and the raccoon was gone. Harold made many trips, gimping and grunting his way to a clean garage. Brittle plastic cracked and rusting lids popped loose, unseen within the dark husk of mechanical history. Sore and tired, Harold finally stowed the wheelbarrow and walked back inside. He checked to confirm that a shotgun was loaded, ate baked beans for a late dinner, turned on the TV, and fell asleep in his easy chair under an old Afghan. Harold snapped awake later. Something moved outside. He muted the TV and crept toward the door. Harold grabbed the shotgun for the raccoon. He didn't want his garbage strewn across the yard again. He opened the back door to survey his moonlit yard. No small denizens of the forest could be seen. Instead, a massive creature was tearing its way out of the tree line. Shadowed hard angles and odd protrusions in the silvery glow, it turned its vacant eye sockets toward the open door. Harold screamed and fired. A patch of turf erupted in buckshot. The flash illuminated a rusty monstrosity, all steel bones, wire sinews, and plastic veins. Harold screamed again and slammed the door as the behemoth accelerated toward the house. Harold shrank away, staring at the back door. He tripped over the end table. A broad section of the roof tore away. He screamed again as the monster leaned into the house and reached for him. The azure glow of the television lit viscous fluid pulsing through the twisted appendage. Harold fired his last shell. Dark liquid splattered across the room, but the arm never flinched as it enveloped him in its grasp. 4 days later, Jimmy called the sheriff to make a welfare check. They found Harold's body, overflowed with a stinking chemical miasma, decaying in his sodden easy chair. The TV was still on. A search of the property found no evidence of foul play. In the woods in back, a deputy was startled by a raccoon leaping from a rusted old Ford. A twining pair of aspens were growing just beside it. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by three judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
Good evening. My name is Susan Haraladui. I'm from Duluth. I have three really short poems. First one's called Moonshine. Goldenrod bends toward light. Dragonflies float on sunshine. In stillness of late summer, I hold you and this day. Drink this winter elixir. September blues. He leaves for his third year of college. Beard, hairy legs, his blue Subaru bulging. At the trail's edge, a mole lies in wait. All around me, maple seeds twirl blush pink. At my feet, a single forget-me-not blooms late. Under a blood moon, toadstools dot the forest. Maple leaves bleed. Dragonflies dance at midday. You stand at this open door, holding my silent invitation. Thank you.
I'm Colleen Lee from Washburn. I just want to preface this piece by saying that most people are surprised when they find out that this piece was written by a woman. And see, I already made my transformation. But I just want to assure you that nobody was more surprised at this male character that came and commandeered my story than I was. My big amp. It was my 15-amp circular saw with the new carbide tip blade that took my finger. Could have been revenge. An eye for an eye, a finger for all the teeth I'd carelessly broken off of it through the years. I didn't think about it at the time. Just picked up my finger, puked, fainted, came to and dialed the sheriff. Maybe it's holding your finger in a glass of salt water on your lap, or maybe it's seeing the land that you've lived on so slowly and deliberately most of your life pass by you at 90 miles an hour. But after 5 minutes of red lights flashing, the sheriff's car lifts off the road, just a little, enough to lose all traction. It's being pulled out from under us like in a video game. I pass out, and when I come to, we're on the Cap Rock Escarpment. Another 30 minutes, and we're in Hereford, Texas. The doc in the ER, looking tired and acting giddy, cleans my wound, tells me, go home, just keep your hand up, and just be sure and ice it. I look at my severed finger in the glass of water, unmoored and homeless. But doc, what about my finger? The doc puts his hand over his mouth and fakes a cough, like he's covering up a laugh or a fart. What's so funny, I wonder, half expecting him to tell me that he doesn't give people the finger. Too mangled, he says. Getting my finger amputated isn't a big surprise. I've been dreading something like this for some time now. Yet at the same time, I've been wondering, curious, what it would be like to lose a part of myself. I'd even started dreaming weird about my dog. Buddy's a blue heeler, part dingo and very intuitive. In my dreams, I'd noticed that one of his legs was missing, a different one each time. Well, eventually I'd find it propped against the toilet or hanging alongside the shovels. But Buddy's eyes are wary now. I think he knows about the dream. He keeps to himself. He won't get in my bed anymore. He sleeps on his belly with his legs tucked under. And It's not like I've never seen people with amputations before. And I'd seen a man with both ears burned off. If you ask me what's the saddest thing I ever saw, I'd have to say it was a young mother on a bus in Juarez with a toddler on her lap. She was playing and laughing with him. The child's arms ended where his elbows should have been, with four little cords of flesh dangling from each arm. My God, the way that mother loved on him, as if her love could grow his arms back. I admired them all. Of course, I didn't know them. Surely losing a big part of themselves like that, they must have felt the very depths of life, must have experienced great wisdom. Looking at my finger, I comfort myself with the thought that now I'll get to feel a little of what they feel, maybe learn a little of what they know. It's been 3 days now, and I'm still in shock. At least I tell myself that must be why I haven't learned a damn thing yet. I check my finger again. It's still in the salt water on the bottom of the glass next to the bed. Maybe I'm hoping someone will come and love on me, and it will jump up and reattach itself. I try to remember what it feels like to be loved. It's getting dark. I move the glass under the bed where I won't trip over it. I spend the night awake in my cushioned platform rocker. The next morning, the sun arrives. Glory, hallelujah, gorgeous, fanning crimson over the morning sky. I'm reminded of the beauty of the caprock, of the canyon lands, of the escarpment. I hold up my glass and toast the sun, forgetting that my finger's in it. The water's clouding up and starting to stink. I thought the worst thing that could happen about getting old would be losing your muscle. But the worst thing is reflecting back on all the times you were such an asshole. You think you know so much, but you don't know a damn thing. That's why I'm here on the escarpment, on the edge of beauty, waiting for things to shift, waiting for the knowledge to come. On the porch, I burrow down in my cushy rocker and watch the sky. Just me, Buddy, and my finger. I guess you could say we're holding awake. The finger gets to smelling really bad. I throw out the water and pull the poor thing out from the glass and carefully lay it in a matchbox. I can't believe it's no longer part of me, but at the same time, I can't believe it ever was. I keep waiting for it to rise up from the dead. When it doesn't, I dig a shallow grave and bury the finger next to my old dog, Tilly, under the basswood tree. I climb back in my rocker and curl up in the womb, in its womb. I think of my mother, of her womb, of me in it, and how I got there. Buddy comes in to check on me, like he always does when he hears me sobbing. I pet him and sob some more, and then I wait. Wait and watch for the wisdom to come. 3 days later, a northeaster is riding the caprock. It's predicted to hit here in 2 hours. The wind picks up. It bowls Buddy and me over. Buddy whimpers and goes inside using three of his legs. I stay to wait for the dawn. That's when I see it, the wisdom. It's out there on the escarpment. It's gathering up itself in sunlit bits and moving closer. It funnels up 4, 8, 12 feet. Just as it starts to lift off the ground, it shifts and spirals toward me. My mind spins with it. I think about Tilly and Buddy and the land, the comfort they have given me. Life passes before me, only it isn't my life, but the animals. Tilly and Buddy, the diamondbacks, the coyotes and prairie dogs. Then the trees moonwalk across my eyes, the buckeyes, mesquites, and cottonwoods. The funnel of wisdom comes closer, deafening me. It bears down on me, revealing every sparkling particle of its wisdom, every shining atom of its knowledge. Then it goes black and touches down on Tilly's grave. I am bursting with love. I strip off my shirt and run to meet it. Invite it in. Let it ransack my heart.
This is Simply Superior. We'll be right back to hear more from this encore recording of Writer's Read right after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. Robin Washington is away. I'm Paul Damberg, WPR's Northern Regional Manager. You are listening to an encore presentation of recordings of works at past Writer's Read events held at Northland College.
I'm J.W. Sutton. This story is called 47625 Town Dump Road. Okay, Pops, I think that's the last of them. Yeah, Jimmy, that good, thanks. Harold watched his son toss two full garbage bags into the overflowing pickup bed. That going to fall out on the highway? No, I've got a tarp to tie over it. Jimmy pulled blue plastic from the back seat of the crew cab. They fine you if you let that crap fly out of the truck and don't pick it up. I know, Pops. Can you help me with this? He began to tie a battered yellow rope at one end of the truck bed. Harold limped off the porch. Where's Christy? Children are for helping. She worked hard for 2 hours. I told her she could take a break. Doing what? Reading a book she found at a garage sale. Jimmy pulled the tarp into place, cinched it, and tossed the line to his father. Reading is good. Harold looped the rope through the tie down. He looked toward the garage. What about all those jugs and cans? That's junk too. Can't take those, Dad. It's hazardous waste. They'll have a collection notice in the paper, but it'll cost you. It's trash. What's the difference? The old solvents, the dirty oil, it would leak out of the landfill and poison the water. Don't they clean the water? I have a garbage pile in back since before I was born. My water is fine. Jimmy sighed. I can't do it, Pops. I don't have the room anyway. Harold frowned, shrugged, and spread his arms. Thank you so much, son. I couldn't do it on my own. Jimmy leaned into the hug, cradling his father's bent back. You're welcome, Pops. I'm glad I could help. Jimmy stepped back. I'll go stack what's left in the garage, okay? Can you please tell Christy that it's time to leave? I think she's out back. Yeah, son. He limped around the house. Christy was curled in a lawn chair, enjoying the fleeting warmth of the autumn sun. Her clothes and skin wore similar patches of grime. What are you reading? He asked.
Hi, Papa. It's called Tales of the Green Man. It's a bunch of short stories.
Green Man? Is that some hippie thing? Christy chuckled.
No, nothing like that.
She turned the cover for him to see, an old man with leaves for hair and moss for a beard.
The Green Man is like a forest spirit or fairy. He defends nature in the wild places of the world.
Like a ghost?
She shrugged. Sometimes a stranger rewarding kindness. Sometimes a monster seeking revenge.
Harold raised his eyebrows. Anyway, your father said it's time to go.
Thanks, Papa.
Thank you. You worked hard today. I see it on your face. He wiped a smudge off her cheek.
No problem.
She matched his pace until they rounded the corner. Hop in, kiddo. She gave her grandfather a last quick squeeze. He patted her back. Take care. Call me if you need anything, Pops. I will. Jimmy engulfed Harold in a gentle hug, mindful of the older man's back. Remember to keep an eye out for that hazardous waste pickup.
Yeah, I'll look, he agreed.
Jimmy hopped in the truck. Christy waved. Harold hobbled back inside. It was nearly sunset when the old man returned to the garage. I'm not going to pay some person to take this. That's what I pay taxes for. He opened one of the jugs Jimmy had carefully shelled. Oh, smells awful. Harold surveyed the accumulated waste, decades worth of lubricants and antifreeze and satin finish in the emerald green his wife had loved. I think it is time to take a trip to the garbage pile. He loaded a few jugs into a small wheelbarrow and trudged across the lawn into the trees beyond. 100 yards into the army of wooden sentinels, Harold came upon a rusted Ford. Dragged here by his father, it had decayed so long that a pair of aspens had sprouted and twisted together through the vacant windshield. Scattered and piled around it were bald tires, a bent boat trailer, and less easily identifiable bottles and cans and shards. Harold grabbed the first plastic jug and tossed it into the open passenger window of the old auto. As it crashed inside, a blur rushed across the forest floor and bolted up the nearest tree. Harold clutched at his chest as he jumped back. A raccoon berated him from his safe perch. Bastard!
I see you again, I get you with my shotgun. The raccoon merely blinked. Ha, laughed Harold. The best thing about living out here is no one hears how noisy I am. Harold pitched the rest of the rancid chemicals into his corroded private dump. He spit toward the raccoon and wheeled his way back to the garage. The full moon lit his path. When he returned with another load of refuse, the shadows were deeper and the raccoon was gone. Harold made many trips, gimping and grunting his way to a clean garage. Brittle plastic cracked, and rusting lids popped loose, unseen within the dark husk of mechanical history. Sore and tired, Harold finally stowed the wheelbarrow and walked back inside. He checked to confirm that a shotgun was loaded, ate baked beans for a late dinner, turned on the TV, and fell asleep in his easy chair under an old Afghan. Harold snapped awake later. Something moved outside. He muted the TV and crept toward the door. Harold grabbed the shotgun for the raccoon. He didn't want his garbage strewn across the yard again. He opened the back door to survey his moonlit yard. No small denizens of the forest could be seen. Instead, a massive creature was tearing its way out of the tree line. Shadowed hard angles and odd protrusions in the silvery glow, it turned its vacant eye sockets toward the open door. Harold screamed and fired. A patch of turf erupted in buckshot. The flash illuminated a rusty monstrosity, all steel bones, wire sinews, and plastic veins. Harold screamed again and slammed the door as the behemoth accelerated toward the house. Harold shrank away, staring at the back door. He tripped over the end table. A broad section of the roof tore away. He screamed again as the monster leaned into the house and reached for him. The azure glow of the television lit viscous fluid pulsing through the twisted appendage. Harold fired his last shell. Dark liquid splattered across the room, but the arm never flinched as it enveloped him in its grasp. 4 days later, Jimmy called the sheriff to make a welfare check. They found Harold's body, overflowed with a stinking chemical miasma, decaying in his sodden easy chair. The TV was still on. A search of the property found no evidence of foul play. In the woods in back, a deputy was startled by a raccoon leaping from a rusted old Ford. A twining pair of aspens were growing just beside it. Thank you.
You're listening to Writer's Read, From a Frog to Prince, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
Good evening. My name is Susan Paraladui. I'm from Duluth. I have 3 really short poems. First one's called Moonshine. Goldenrod bends toward light. Dragonflies float on sunshine. In stillness of late summer, I hold you and this day. Drink this winter elixir. September blues. He leaves for his 3rd year of college. Beard, hairy legs, his blue Subaru bulging. At the trail's edge, a mole lies in wait. All around me, maple seeds twirl blush pink. At my feet, a single forget-me-not blooms late. Under a blood moon, toadstools dot the forest. Maple leaves bleed. Dragonflies dance at midday. You stand at this open door, holding my silent invitation. Thank you.
I'm Colleen Lee from Washburn. I just want to preface this piece by saying that most people are surprised when they find out that this piece was written by a woman. And see, I already made my transformation. But I just want to assure you that nobody was more surprised at this male character that came and commandeered my story than I was. My big amp, it was my 15-amp circular saw with the new carbide tip blade that took my finger. Could have been revenge. An eye for an eye, a finger for all the teeth I'd carelessly broken off of it through the years. I didn't think about it at the time. Just picked up my finger, puked, fainted, came to and dialed the sheriff. Maybe it's holding your finger in a glass of salt water on your lap, or maybe it's seeing the land that you've lived on so slowly and deliberately most of your life pass by you at 90 miles an hour. But after 5 minutes of red lights flashing, the sheriff's car lifts off the road, just a little, enough to lose all traction. It's being pulled out from under us like in a video game. I pass out, and when I come to, we're on the Cap Rock Escarpment. Another 30 minutes, and we're in Hereford, Texas. The doc in the ER, looking tired and acting giddy, cleans my wound, tells me, go home, just keep your hand up, and just be sure and ice it. I look at my severed finger in the glass of water, unmoored and homeless. But doc, what about my finger? The doc puts his hand over his mouth and fakes a cough, like he's covering up a laugh or a fart. What's so funny, I wonder, half expecting him to tell me that he doesn't give people the finger. Too mangled, he says. Getting my finger amputated isn't a big surprise. I've been dreading something like this for some time now. Yet at the same time, I've been wondering, curious, what it would be like to lose a part of myself. I'd even started dreaming weird shit about my dog. Buddy's a blue heeler, part dingo and very intuitive. In my dreams, I'd noticed that one of his legs was missing, a different one each time. Well, eventually I'd find it propped against the toilet or hanging alongside the shovels. But Buddy's eyes are wary now. I think he knows about the dream. He keeps to himself. He won't get in my bed anymore. He sleeps on his belly with his legs tucked under. It's not like I've never seen people with amputations before. And I'd seen a man with both ears burned off. If you ask me what's the saddest thing I ever saw, I'd have to say it was a young mother on a bus in Juarez with a toddler on her lap. She was playing and laughing with him. The child's arms ended where his elbows should have been, with four little cords of flesh dangling from each arm. My God, the way that mother loved on him, as if her love could grow his arms back. I admired them all. Of course, I didn't know them. Surely losing a big part of themselves like that, they must have felt the very depths of life, must have experienced great wisdom. Looking at my finger, I comfort myself with the thought that now I'll get to feel a little of what they feel, maybe learn a little of what they know. It's been 3 days now, and I'm still in shock. At least I tell myself that must be why I haven't learned a damn thing yet. I check my finger again. It's still in the salt water on the bottom of the glass next to the bed. Maybe I'm hoping someone will come and love on me and it will jump up and reattach itself. I try to remember what it feels like to be loved. It's getting dark. I move the glass under the bed where I won't trip over it. I spend the night awake in my cushioned platform rocker. The next morning, the sun arrives. Glory, hallelujah, gorgeous, fanning crimson over the morning sky. I am reminded of the beauty of the Cap Rock, of the canyon lands, of the escarpment. I hold up my glass and toast the sun, forgetting that my finger's in it. The water's clouding up and starting to stink. I thought the worst thing that could happen about getting old would be losing your muscle. But the worst thing is reflecting back on all the times you were such an asshole. You think you know so much, but you don't know a damn thing. That's why I'm here on the escarpment, on the edge of beauty, waiting for things to shift, waiting for the knowledge to come. On the porch, I burrow down in my cushy rocker and watch the sky. Just me, Buddy, and my finger. I guess you could say we're holding awake. The finger gets to smelling really bad. I throw out the water and pull the poor thing out from the glass and carefully lay it in a matchbox. I can't believe it's no longer part of me, but at the same time, I can't believe it ever was. I keep waiting for it to rise up from the dead. When it doesn't, I dig a shallow grave and bury the finger next to my old dog Tilly under the basswood tree. I climb back in my rocker and curl up in the womb, in its womb. I think of my mother, of her womb, of me in it, and how I got there. Buddy comes in to check on me, like he always does when he hears me sobbing. I pet him and sob some more, and then I wait. Wait and watch for the wisdom to come. 3 days later, a northeaster is riding the Cap Rock. It's predicted to hit here in 2 hours. The wind picks up. It bowls Buddy and me over. Buddy whimpers and goes inside using three of his legs. I stay to wait for the dawn. That's when I see it, the wisdom. It's out there on the escarpment. It's gathering up itself in sunlit bits and moving closer. It funnels up 4, 8, 12 feet. Just as it starts to lift off the ground, it shifts and spirals toward me. My mind spins with it. I think about Tilly and Buddy and the land, the comfort they have given me. Life passes before me, only it isn't my life, but the animals. Tilly and Buddy, the diamondbacks, the coyotes and prairie dogs. Then the trees moonwalk across my eyes, the buckeyes, mesquites, and cottonwoods. The funnel of wisdom comes closer, deafening me. It bears down on me, revealing every sparkling particle of its wisdom, every shining atom of its knowledge. Then it goes black and touches down on Tilly's grave. I am bursting with love. I strip off my shirt and run to meet it. Invite it in. Let it ransack my heart.
This is Simply Superior. We'll be right back to hear more from this encore recording of Writer's Read right after this.
Hello, my name is Maridel Call, and I'm from Duluth, and I have 4 poems to read. They tend to show that transformation can happen anywhere. The first one happens at a bus stop. The second one happens on the surface of Lake Superior. The third one happens on Highway 53, heading south, and the last one takes place in a rock. First day of class at the university for seniors. I tell my sister of my plans to catch the number 6 bus. I can reach the plaza at the college in 9 minutes. She says, be sure to bring your backpack. I find it, now 40 years old, in my upstairs closet. Dig out my composition notebook, pack cheese and apple, count my quarters, exactly 3. The driver doesn't make change. I stand at the stop across the street, wait with my 5-year-old self, wearing her new red plaid dress, carrying her Minnie Mouse lunchbox, wait as she clutches her mother's hand while the bus lumbers up the street in sharp September light. The next one is called Silver Linings. This mean spring day smothers the Wisconsin shore with fog, forces an oar boat behind gray scrim, punches grizzled waves across the lakes toward the rocks, exploding them into a shower of white chrysanthemums. The next one is called Winter Ceremony. 1. At true solar noon, when sun at its highest point is low, one eagle, 3 crows, shadows tall on the snow, gather on a shoulder of highway to pick clean the rib cage of a deer. 2. At dusk, when sky shivers gold at the end of a tunneled forest, black wings clamber to the tops of pines, white tail feathers glide through bare-fingered branches of birch. 3. At midnight, Orion wraps stars around white bisque bones left at the side of a road. As I light one candle in a house across the field. And the last poem is called Agates. Tumbled for epochs along wave-battered shores, these stones speak of lava runs, water rage, crawling ice, wind bite. Circled round in rings of light, rust orange, yellow, red, glimpsed through layers rugged with time, these stones seduce with the shine of Venus in evening skies. Thank you.
You're listening to Writer's Read, From a Frog to Prince, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
My name is Felicia Schneider-Hahn, and this is an excerpt from my memoir called Newlyweds Afloat. The memoir is about the more than 2 years that my husband Mark and I spent living on a trawler downtown Chicago. So this excerpt is from a chapter called A Boat from Temperance. One early morning at the service dock, I was standing by the stern, looking everything over, when the home port of our houseboat caught my eye. Beneath the boat's name, Mazurka, it read, Temperance, Michigan. "Hey, Mark," I called. "This is a temperance boat." Temperance, a small town in the lower southeast corner of Michigan, close to Toledo and Lake Erie, was a long way from our home in Chicago. Random House Webster's College Dictionary defines temperance as 1. Moderation or self-restraint, self-control. 2. Habitual moderation in any indulgence, appetite, etc. 3. Total abstinence from alcoholic liquors. This three-part definition pretty much sums up in chronological order how I drank. I started moderately with whiskey and wine and proceeded to habitual moderation in that I made it a habit to drink often. Moderation is up for debate. My drinking came up a few times while we dated. Once, Mark called me at my apartment. "Why are all these empty bottles on my shelf?" I knew exactly why they were there. When he was away and I hung out alone on his boat, I had drunk up a lot of his liquor. I worried what he would say if he noticed a bunch of bottles missing, and I knew he wouldn't touch them on his own. So I left the empty bottles on the shelf. On the phone, I didn't confess this. I said something about him making me feel guilty for drinking, and he dropped the subject. About 4 months into our marriage, I told Mark I wanted to quit my day job and pursue my dream of writing full time. Mark is an exceptionally kind, generous person who wanted to do whatever he could to help me achieve my dream. He said, "Of course." And by February, I became a full-time freelance writer. And without my realizing it, my daily life soon became a habit of hiding how much I drank. Afternoons were dangerous times for me. If I was home alone, the agitation of the day would build, and by 2 o'clock, I would start looking for relief. I would pour one glass of wine and tell myself that's all I'll be having. But before that first glass was even half gone, I was itching for the next one. And then there was the trick of getting drunk, but not too drunk. Just drunk enough to be buzzed, but still able to hide it from Mark. About half an hour before he came home, I would stop drinking, eat something, and brush my teeth. After he arrived home, I had to get dinner on the table and make sure we sat down to eat as quickly as possible, so that I could open a bottle of wine with dinner and continue the buzz. I would suck down 2 glasses, then insist on cleaning up and shoo him from the salon so I could finish off the remaining wine in his glass and the rest of the bottle. If he had something to do before dinner, if dinner was delayed even half an hour, I was certain he was doing it on purpose because he knew I wanted to drink and he was trying to stop me. My days started to revolve around when it was time to drink and the need to hide it from everyone around me. I yearned for places I could drink openly. And it was this impulse that, when we brought my parents on board for a Father's Day fishing excursion, led me to an all-out 3-day drinking binge. On the third morning, when everyone else was up at 5 to fish, I was up to drink. I was blitzed by 10 a.m., passed out with the spins by 1. I woke in the late afternoon as we pulled into port, half drunk, half hungover. My parents sensed trouble brewing and took a trip out in the Zodiac raft. We were alone in the salon, and Mark told me, "I just don't like all the drinking." And then he said the kicker, "It makes me wonder about having kids." "What?" I said, "that their mother will be a drunk?" "No," he said. "What they'll inherit." This stopped me. This I could not argue. We both have alcoholism in our bloodlines. I knew I was an alcoholic. I had known for a long time. But I didn't want to believe that being alcoholic meant I could no longer drink. Why not be a functional alcoholic? Except I was no longer functioning. I knew I couldn't control it, and I wouldn't be able to control whether our children got it either. The most I would be able to do would be to model for them what it was like to live as a sober alcoholic. The next day, Father's Day, as we cruised along Lake Michigan in a plague of swarming black flies, I did not drink. The following day, back in Chicago, I went up to the flybridge alone and made a phone call to ask for help. It was the first stride on a long road of recovery. As days passed and the fog of alcohol began to clear, I slowly started walking through a day completely sober. I began to see how everything I did all day long had been attached to drinking. And now, without the crutch of alcohol, emotions came down on me full force, and I physically ached with the new experience of being checked in all the time. For the first time as an adult, I was learning to be a full participant in life. Mark supported anything I said I needed to do to learn this new way of life. He wasn't surprised to hear me say I was an alcoholic, and he did not try to control my recovery. The one night, he confessed, "I knew there was something wrong in our marriage," he said. "I just thought the problem was me." That summer, I was too embarrassed to tell people I had stopped drinking and they shouldn't bring wine on board our boat. So I said nothing, and guests kept bringing wine. One night, about a month into sobriety, after we returned to A-Dock and our guests had gone, I looked at the shelf and saw 8 bottles of red wine staring back at me. 8 bottles. I had never had 8 bottles of wine in my house, ever. I had fantasized about having a full wine cellar, but if there was one bottle, I drank it. I turned to my husband. "Can you give some of this away?" So, Mark started up and down A-Dock, not finding it too difficult to give away Malbec and Cabernet and Shiraz to our neighbors aboard the Absolute and Cranberry. Rolling Rock 2 in green font, just like the label. Bumpy Night, flanked by 2 little martini glasses. And my favorite, Aquaholics. Somewhere in Chicago cruised the Betty Ford and Ship-Faced. That was cool. But me, I started living on a boat from Temperance. Thank you.
That's it for our program. You have been listening to an encore presentation of original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry recorded at past Writers Read events at Northland College. That is it for this week's Simply Superior. I'm Paul Damberg. Be safe and enjoy.